You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
An environment in which there are lakes of putrid slush, foul odors wafting in the breeze, and entire rivers turning orange may sound like something out of Cormac McCarthy's novel, The Road, but it's reality for many people who live near industrial farms, the result of keeping thousands of animals in one place to keep food prices low. In his latest book, Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment, David Kirby follows three unlikely grassroots activists who have opposed big agriculture, from small community protesters to the national sustainability movement. David Kirby joins us now to discuss his book, which is published by St. Martin's Press. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Leonard. I'm really happy to be here.
And I'm grateful your name isn't Cormac McCarthy, because I always stumble over it for some reason. Does it take a special dedication and a weak sense of smell to spend 3 years contemplating animal waste?
Yeah, I never knew manure could be so challenging. I spent 2 years on the road. I went to 20 different states around the country, and the situation was the same everywhere I went. And it was the odor was the number one complaint of people I spoke to. One of the worst things about the odor is that it's intermittent and unpredictable. And people in rural areas that live near these large factory farms with their liquefied manure lagoons emitting these gases and odors don't know when they can or cannot go outside and enjoy their own property. And I think it's that not knowing that really gets under their skin.
Now, you said a lagoon. We're not talking about a Caribbean getaway here.
No Gilligan's Island here, no. These are massive cesspools, basically, open pools of water into which waste is pumped on a regular basis. These animals are contained in giant barns. You've probably seen them from the airplane, those long, white, narrow buildings stretched out 3, 4, 5 in a row. And usually, with the pigs, for example, there are slotted floors, and their feces and urine drop into these pits below them where it's mixed with water and then pumped out into this lagoon. Those are often 20, 30 million gallons, and they're held there until such time that they can be sprayed onto cropland, both for waste management and for fertilizer.
So they can be used as fertilizer. There is something positive that comes out of this. But how long between the time they wind up in the lagoon and the time that they use as fertilizer?
It could take months. And in the meantime, that lagoon is evaporating and emitting gases and ammonia.
Methane,
hydrogen sulfide, which is very dangerous.
And so we're talking global warming here, too.
Oh, yes, yes. This industry is definitely contributing to global warming as well.
You say that 2% of U.S. livestock facilities now raise 40% of all animals. So is it because this is the most efficient way to do things?
It is an extremely efficient, productive way. It's really quite a marvel that we can produce so much food so quickly and so cheaply. And by cheaply, I mean the price tag at the supermarket. The hidden costs are what are so concerning to people. And we as a society absorb those costs, both in terms of public health and in terms of the environment.
Well, how is it done in smaller farms?
Well, a small farm, which is the way we've been farming as humans for tens of thousands of years, people think organic farming is something new. It's anything that predates maybe 1930, are closed systems. They're agronomic. So the animals will graze on pasture and grassland and then defecate there in the field. Those nutrients then go into the soil to feed the plants, which then grow to feed the animals. In a CAFO, which is a concentrated animal feeding operation, you have far too many animals on the amount of land to support them. Therefore, you have to do two things. You have to import nutrients to feed all these animals, and then you have to somehow export off-site all of the manure that they're generating. And that's where the problems really come in.
Does it affect the taste of pork? Because pork used to be very different in the 40s and 50s than it is today.
I have heard people say that it does.
Well, it's lower fat now, and Ruth Reichel used to complain about that. She felt that fat mm-hmm. was really important for the flavor.
Yeah, I stayed on some sustainable pork farms in Iowa and Illinois when I was doing my research, and the pigs were right outside living very happily, I have to say, in their little communes. And we'd get up in the morning and have bacon, and I knew exactly where it came from. I don't eat a lot of pork, but I didn't want to be rude either, and it tasted absolutely delicious. The pork that is bred in the CAFOs, as you said, it's genetically designed to be very low fat. The pigs grow at a very fast rate, and they grow to the exact same size and shape. The really flavorful pork comes from Berkshire, from heritage breeds that aren't produced in a factory farm setting.
Now, how do these farms work? Don't farmers actually agree to work for a larger corporation?
Most of the time, yes. These farmers are contractors. They're almost like sharecroppers, really.
So why would they even choose to do it that way?
Because they are part of this. They fall victim to the system just like all of us, and we all contribute to the system. When we demand cheap meat, when we go to a big box store and buy a big box of meat, we are participating, and the farmer basically has no choice. If they want to stay in agriculture, if they want to grow animals, it's at this point very, very difficult to stay in business as a small guy.
But don't these farmers have to take on a lot of debt just to build the facilities required by the larger companies?
Yeah, I describe in the book an animal factory. They go in up to over $1 million in debt. It's a great deal for the companies. They own the animals from the get-go. They own the semen stock. And they own those animals right through birth and nursing and fattening and feeding and slaughtering and marketing until they're in the cellophane in the supermarket. And these growers, they incur the debt. They have to build these giant barns and all the mechanized. It's very, very capital intensive. And they're also liable for all the manure. The company basically pays them per animal that's delivered to the slaughterhouse.
So the less money they spend on taking care of the manure, the higher their profits. And they have to pay off this debt, don't they? How long does it usually take them to do that before they can actually turn a profit?
It depends on what type of CAFO, what type of factory farm they're running. It can take 10 or 20 years sometimes. The chicken farmers only net about $8,000 to $15,000 a year per house. So it takes a long time.
My guest is David Kirby of the Huffington Post, formerly with the New York Times, weren't you?
I contributed to New York Times, yes.
And author of the New York Times bestseller, Evidence of Harm, his latest book, Animal Factory, with a title slightly reminiscent of George Orwell, although I'm assuming you're saying this is kind of an Orwellian situation.
It is. I was surprised at the way the animals are kept and treated in such huge numbers. It's pretty unimaginable.
Now, how does your book differ from other investigations into our food system, like Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation or a documentary like Food Incorporated?
I would say it really deals with the people who are most affected, directly impacted by these CAFOs. These are bedrock conservative Americans. Most of them are farmers themselves. They've been living and farming where they are for generations sometimes.
Republicans often?
Absolutely, almost. They all began as Republicans. By the end of the book, there's very few Republicans left among my characters. That doesn't mean they're hardcore liberal Democrats, but they were very unhappy with the Bush years.
Well, you focus on pig, dairy, and poultry operations. Is it different with beef or fish farming, or do you think you would have come up with similar kinds of stories?
Well, I mainly focus on those because the characters I chose, those were the farms that they were dealing with. Fish farming is not without its problems. I mean, you could write a very good book about fish farming. One of the biggest things is that the diseases that the farm fish have, or the farm fish escape, and things like sea lice and everything will contaminate wild fish. Beef is interesting, and I mentioned in the introduction that of all the animals that we grow in this country, beef is probably the least problematic. That doesn't give it a free pass. And most beef is still raised by independent producers who are not part of a larger corporate food system. It's often raised on grassland or pasture land that won't support plant or crop agriculture. And they do go to feedlots typically, except for grass-fed beef, at the end of their life. So for the last 3 or 4 months, they are definitely in a CAFO situation. But it is unlike the dairy or the chicken or the pig farms where it's all CAFO all the time.
Let's talk about Rick Dove, one of the people that you profile here. He's a Marine veteran, and you say was a Republican.
He was. He shot one of the MoveOn.org ads, Republicans for Kerry, in 2000, or 2004, excuse me. He was so fed up with the Bush administration and the EPA back then not enforcing the law, and he did make an ad, and he is a former Marine. He looks like it. He talks like it. He's a great guy. I'll be down in North Carolina next week to do some stuff with him.
He became the riverkeeper for the Neuse River, Neuse River, Where is that? How far is it from the large cities of North Carolina, Charlotte, Raleigh, Chapel mm-hmm. Hill?
The Noose begins just outside of Durham, and it goes about 230 miles southeast towards Pamlico Sound, where it empties out into a very broad estuary in a little town called New Bern, which is where Rick lives. And it's a very interesting place. It's very, very rich in fish life and sea life. And what happened there was this little protozoa called Pfisteria started turning up and literally eating holes into the fish and killing them by the millions. At one point, there was a fish kill as big as a billion fish. And Rick went up into the air and found all of these massive hog farms with their giant lagoons just feet away from canals and streams and watershed.
So he made the connection that that all the spillage into the river was leading to this Pfisteria infestation. Pfisteria called the cell from hell.
Cell from hell. It is a nasty little bug. Yes. Now, it's important to note, it's not just agriculture that's contributing to the nutrients in the Noose River that create situations where Pfisteria can thrive. There are other pollutants. We all pollute through our own wastewater systems, municipal systems, so agriculture is not the only culprit.
But it is, you said that this waste, this pig manure gets used for fertilizer. Obviously, it's being dumped into rivers. Is it being done into it by accident?
Sometimes it's done intentionally. Rick took me, again, they have so much liquid manure to get rid of, and in North Carolina, it's kind of silly. They're out there spraying their fields night and day as fertilizer, but they're growing things like Bermuda grass and hay basically to absorb all the nutrients they're spraying onto the field. A lot of that has so much nitrogen in it, they can't even feed it back to the animals. So there is overapplication, and I saw people deliberately spraying right into creeks and streams.
Now, you mentioned Pfisteria affecting the fish, but didn't Rick notice that his own health was being affected?
Yes, and a lot of the fishermen on the river, when this Pfisteria is active, it emits a toxin. And if you inhale that, you become very disoriented. You lose your memory. Fishermen were getting lost. They couldn't remember how to get home on their boats. And Rick began having those, as well as the same sores that they saw in the fish, they started seeing on their own skin.
So is this something that people in North Carolina were paying attention to?
Yes. Now, this was in the mid to late 90s. It was a huge story at the time. It made national headlines, and it was quite a conundrum, and of course it was hurting tourism and everything. Then along came two hurricanes, and then the third big hurricane, who was Floyd, which basically came and wiped out the entire river basin and all the creeks. And since then, there haven't been any big Pfisteria outbreaks, but the nutrient levels again are rising in the river. Those hurricanes themselves did unbelievable damage, and of course,
did they hurt the pig farms?
Oh, they wiped them out, and every lagoon got washed away, and the pigs were literally bobbing around like beach balls. Just one interesting thing about that: these pigs are bred to be indoors, and when the water came and swept them outside, they were still alive, trying to swim around. They had never been outside in their life; they had never seen sunlight in their life, and their skin became burned and blistered because they had never been out in the sun before.
Now, was all the stuff just washed into the Atlantic Ocean?
Yes, there were sharks feeding on dead pigs bobbing around in the water, along with billions and billions and billions of gallons of waste.
Did the state get involved in working with this? After all, you said it affected tourism. I'm sure there had been many complaints about the smells, not just from this one guy.
Yeah. The state has gotten involved, and the problem in all states is enforcement and the political culture in the state. How much do they want to support agriculture, and how much are they willing to tolerate residents being sprayed with liquid waste?
Do you think this is a rural, urban situation? People in the cities don't care?
They may not know. It's also a rich-poor situation, and there is racial injustice going on, too. A lot of poor African-American communities in North Carolina and Latino-American communities in the West bear the brunt of this air and water pollution from these facilities.
My guest is David Kirby. His latest book, Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment, published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with David Kirby, whose book, Animal Factory, The Looming Threat of Industrial Pig, Dairy, and Poultry Farms to Humans and the Environment, is published by St. Martin's Press. We've been talking about pig farms. I don't know if we've completed that discussion, but should we move on to some of the other things that you discuss here? Are they all pretty much part of the same problem?
They are. They have their own particular problems. The Western dairies, where the cows are out on big dry lots, the manure bakes in the sun and the cows grind it up with their hooves and it blows into the air in particulate matter, and you literally are breathing in ground feces. And every time I came back from the West, I would have what they call manure flu, a headache and chills and fever and a cough, and it was very, very nasty. And when I opened my suitcase, the luggage would stink. So that was particularly bad.
Now, we should point out that some of the people involved in this on the other side have strong political connections. You've written about a man named Wendell Murphy. How does he get what he wants?
Wendell Murphy was the original boss hog. He was the subject of a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Raleigh-Durham paper, the Raleigh News and Observer. He typifies... many of the people who are involved in this industry. He was actually both. He was both a state legislator and the owner of several large hog farms, which he then evolved into his own company. It's now been bought out by Smithfield.
Smithfield,
the largest pork producer in the world. He was able to write legislation even as he owned the hog farms to benefit his own company.
And he was also involved in another case that you discussed in the book in Elmwood, Illinois. What was going on there?
Correct. Well, that's the story of Karen Hudson, one of my main characters, who started a group called Families Against Rural Messes after Murphy tried to come in, or did come in, and started contracting. The company contracted with the county commissioner of Knox County, which is right next to Peoria County, in a tiny little town called Williamsfield. And this literally split a family apart. The guy's two brothers, who had farms right across the street and next door, begged him not to do this, the county commissioner. He went ahead and contracted with Murphy. And, of course, terrible things happened to the community. And one of the brother and his wife ended up having to move away. And, of course, their property value plummeted after the announcement came. They could not sell their farm. And so the brother, who had the pig farm, ended up buying it from them way below cost for his workers.
Is it harder for an independent farmer to continue to work when he's in a town that's dominated by one of these big farms?
It's almost impossible. And as the rise of industrial farming increased, we saw more and more small family farms getting wiped out. They just cannot compete with that type of economy of scale.
So what happens to the people who live nearby, the people who are not involved in pig farming, who you say just hate the smell? Do they just move away? Is there no other option for them?
Several of them have moved away and even abandoned their properties because they can't sell them for more than 50 cents on the dollar. Mostly they just bear it, and they fight back, and that's what my book is about. These are people defending their communities. And it's not just the smell, it's groundwater being contaminated. Up in Yakima Valley, which is the third story, they're finding high levels of nitrates in the well water. The EPA is up there right now testing, and one suspects that they're going to think that it's cow manure causing it.
Well, in the case of Karen Hudson, at one point you say she became so frustrated with the process that she burned all of her research.
That was Helen, actually, who did that in Washington. But she was so fed up with the lack of government response. And, you know,
that was Helen working on dairy farms.
Helen working on dairy farms in Yakima Valley, correct.
Mm-hmm. Dairy farms are hard to sell with the public because I can see people saying, well, you know, pig farms, they're disgusting. They love to wallow in mud.
Sure.
But dairy farms, they give us healthful milk.
Dairy has a very special place in the American iconography, if you will, and that's part of the problem. Dairy also has very, very good PR. Now, there are wonderful dairies in this country. I've seen them where the cows are out on pasture. My parents live in Sonoma County. There's lots of organic dairies there, even in Washington State. Wisconsin has a very, you know, they're fighting right now how many CAFOs they want to allow into Wisconsin to protect the brand made in Wisconsin. Vermont has lovely dairies. But the rest of them are these big industrial 10, 20, 30,000 cows And again, in the West, they're all outside, and it's filthy. But we get commercials such as the Happy Cows from California, and I've seen those cows. They're not particularly happy. One interesting thing about those commercials, they're now filming them in New Zealand, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Some of the people you've profiled, like Rick Dove and Karen Hudson, seem to have an intuitive sense for good PR. You think they would have become PR people or advertising people if they had grown up in the big cities?
No, I don't. I think Rick would be out fishing on the river right now if he could be doing anything. And Karen would probably be helping her husband with the corn and bean farm. They own a beautiful farm in Illinois. They have an uncanny sense of how to get the media, and they've done an extremely good job. But they're farmers and fishermen, and they would love to just go back to their lives, I'm sure.
Well, the large agricultural companies seem to have consistently declined interview requests that would have given them a chance to answer the charges made against them.
I agree. And in the cases where they did, I tried to put that into the book, and I did interview people from the American Farm Bureau, and the National Chicken Council was actually made themselves quite available. In Indiana, the Indiana pork people were extremely friendly and open and took me on site to some of their farms. And, of course, they took me to the award-winning farms where everything was done by the book. The pigs were clean. They took me. They were just.
Well, what did they do with the manure?
Well, they have a wonderful program on that particular farm where they don't liquefy it. They separate out the solids. They burn off the methane to create electricity, and then they compost the solid waste and give it to local farmers for manure.
So others could do that?
Others could. They generally don't.
And, because it would be more expensive?
It's very expensive, and they're on a very tight profit margin. A lot of this is done on the honor system. They might have to file a manure management plan with the state, and even fill out forms to show exactly how many nutrients they apply to the field and what they did with their lagoon water. But again, it's honor system, and there's not a lot of enforcement.
You point out that you're not a vegetarian and you occasionally even eat fast food. Why is it important for you to not offer advice on how to eat? I mean, you must have thought about it a lot while you were preparing this book.
I did, and I think advice is one thing. Preaching is another. I don't want anybody telling me what to eat, and I'm not going to tell other people. I did write a piece in the Huffington Post about 6 baby steps you can take to trying to wean yourself off of factory-farmed food. I think the most important thing is to educate yourself and inform yourself. We have rights as consumers, and I think we have a right to choose alternatives to factory-farmed food. But there are cash-strapped families in this country who are being evicted from their homes. They're not going to be thinking about spending $2 or $3 more a pound for non-factory farm foods. But there are steps you can take.
Well, whenever I've had someone like Alice Waters here, there have been listener responses that suggest that she and others are elitists because they're suggesting that we change our eating habits and spend a lot more money because that's what's available. But their response is that these farms that produce things for very low cost are actually being subsidized by the government. Why doesn't the government instead subsidize farms that don't destroy the environment?
Well, this leads to the whole political situation, and food is so political in this country. Obama made lots of promises when he was campaigning on this very issue. Again, I'll be writing about this on Huffington Post, and has not followed through on a lot of them. But there are several specific steps that he said he would take to level the playing field. These big farms push out the little farms, and there has to be a way to kind of equalize that, and subsidies is a really good way. Now, Obama wanted to put a $250,000 cap on all subsidies. Congress is probably going to shoot that idea down. Obama also just backed off on a promise to prevent large farms from breaking themselves up into smaller paper farms on paper, to get the subsidies. Obama's not going to stop that practice. The thing we really need to do is get more processing plants in this country. We have very, very few of them left. And think of it as an hourglass, and this is the narrow neck in the hourglass. Everything that's produced up above has to go through this very narrow passage to get to us, the consumers. That tends to shut out the little producer and makes it very, very hard for them to get their products to market. If we had more fairness in the marketplace, and if people, like I said, educated themselves and informed themselves, they would seek out these alternatives and choose how they were going to sacrifice something else in order to pay for sustainable protein.
Well, it doesn't just end at the farm. In many cases, we then go to processing plants where people are paid minimum wage, sometimes less than a minimum wage, to do jobs that are repetitive and almost impossible to last at. Most of them illegal aliens, because they're the only ones who are willing to stay at those horrible jobs.
Yeah, I didn't write very much about processing plants, but that is the whole other half of this story. There were some people getting very, very sick recently. They worked at something called the head table, where you literally blast out bits of brain from the skull with high-powered air hoses. And these people were breathing the mist that came out and getting this horrible neurological disease. They still haven't quite pinpointed the source.
That's almost like mad cow disease, because so often that is connected to brain.
Yeah. Well, I write quite a bit about mad. The first mad cow in the United States was in Yakima Valley in a dairy in Washington.
And do we know why?
Well, you get mad cow from feeding cows to cows. And I have an email right now to the USDA that has remained unanswered. In the Bush years, they allowed feeding cows to cows in three different ways. Restaurant scraps that contain beef products were fed to cows. This is going to grow.
Aren't cows vegetarians?
Well, if you grind it up and put it in their feed, they're going to eat it. They wouldn't munch on a steak necessarily, but they don't know it's in there. This is gross, but chicken litter, chicken waste, we feed beef products to chicken, and when they peck on it, it falls into their own litter and waste. We often scoop up that waste and feed it to cows, believe it or not. And the third way is on dairies, when a baby calf is born, they take it from the mother immediately, because that milk is too valuable. You get money for that milk, and they put the calf on formula. Well, that formula is made with blood meal from cows. So, and we also feed pet food to cows sometimes. So that's three or four different ways that a cow might end up eating bovine products, and that's how mad cow happens.
You quote Rick Dove as saying that Mother Nature is starting to take control. What does he mean by that?
He says, and I tend to agree with him, that what we're doing is unsustainable, and Mother Nature will have the last word, and she has issued several warnings. These animals were not designed, they are not genetically prepared to live their lives in confinement without access to pasture and fresh air and sunshine, packed in by the hundreds and thousands with all the disease. So Mother Nature is going to strike back through MRSA, which we're seeing, through mad cow disease, through swine flu. We keep getting one warning after another, and Rick believes that one day this is going to come back to bite us big time, and that's going to hurt everybody, including vegetarians and vegans and people who don't participate.
You say pigs are nature's mixing bowls for interspecies infections.
Yes. Swine flu, six of the eight genetic components in the current novel H1N1 were traced back to a hog CAFO, a factory farm in North Carolina. There's a lot of ways that viruses can get into a hog CAFO, and you have so many pigs there that it can mutate very, very rapidly. Pigs tend to be the jumping point between, say, bird flu and human flu. This H1N1 has both bird, swine, and human components to it. A big fear is that I saw in Iowa, you have hog CAFOs right next to poultry CAFOs, very, very close to each other. And if a virus were to jump, let's say an avian virus jumped from the chicken farm to the pig farm and then start mutating in the pigs and then jump over to the workers and then they started spreading into the community, then you have a real nightmare scenario.
Now, antibiotics don't work with viruses.
Correct.
But we are injecting a lot of these animals with antibiotics anyway, aren't we?
We're feeding them antibiotics.
Now, why?
Well, for several reasons. One is, if the animals get sick, obviously you have to treat them. It would be inhumane to just let an animal suffer and have a fever and die. But more to the point, they put it into feed because it makes animals grow faster. Nobody really knows quite why. And it also prevents outbreaks. It's done prophylactically in a large pig house. Low-dose antibiotics tend to keep the disease down, but then, of course, if a microbe evolves and it becomes resistant, then you have a real problem. And a lot of the MRSA, which now kills more people than AIDS in this country, evolves out of these. Not all of it, but a lot of it comes from the pig farms.
Now, you mentioned that President Obama has either backed down or at least is put something on the back burner, all sorts of things that he promised during the campaign. Why do you think that is, and what role do you think his Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, is playing in all of that?
Well, in their defense, I want to say they've done a lot of stuff quietly under the radar. These bureaucracy moves very, very slow. So rules get proposed, they get written, they get reviewed. Things don't happen overnight. And there's good stuff happening, especially at EPA. But Obama, I think, you know, campaigning is different than governing. And I think when he came into office, he realized the heavy pressure that they were going to come under. When you read the quotes from Obama during the campaign, I mean, he was going to take on agribusiness and USDA was going to be for the small farmer and everything. Vilsack is a mixed bag. He's got ties with agribusiness, but he's also very much into both organic farming and trying to tie local production to local consumption. They did just rewrite the organic rules for dairy and for meat, requiring that the animals have to be on pasture for a certain percentage of their life, and a certain part of their diet has to come from pasture. Right now, that's not happening. A lot of people go and buy organic milk from a factory farm, just that the grain that they feed the cows happened to be grown organically.
And so they can make the claim that...
Yes, but that
so they're really just doing the same thing with their cows that the factory farmers are doing.
Absolutely, and that's going to stop thanks to Vilsack.
Well, the president also has a fair number of members of his party from farm states, and he's having a hard enough time keeping them all... under control to get some of the other legislation done. So I imagine that this is an area where he can let things slide, even though it is so important to the nation's health. In fact, to export, because of mad cow, American beef farmers are suffering, aren't they? They are not shipping as much beef overseas as they did in the past.
Beef, pork, chicken, dairy. We have a lot of countries that will take our stuff. After swine flu, that was a huge problem. The Japanese won't buy our pork unless we wean it off antibiotics 4 weeks ahead of time. So if you're going to produce for the Japanese market, you have to take your pig off the drugs much earlier than for the American market, which makes you wonder, what do the Japanese know that we don't?
At the conclusion of the book, Rick Dove says that prayer may be all we have left. We sure can count on most of our elected officials. I'm sure he's not only thinking about the people in Washington, but the people in his state. And on, after all, they all are depending on these farms for support when they run for election. In some cases, they are farmers.
Yeah, yeah.
So is this a pessimistic situation right now?
No.
Can nothing be done?
I think that Rick's side is winning just very, very slowly. I mean, industry has backed off a lot. They do respond to pressure. People do vote with their pocketbooks when they go to the supermarket. But industry is very entrenched right down to the county level. And one thing that Obama also promised to do was support this thing called local control, where counties get to decide whether a large agricultural operation comes in or not. But I think people need to know that in addition to voting with their pocketbook, they need to be on the phone, they need to be calling the White House, they need to be calling their state houses. There's some legislation, both good and bad, running around Washington right now. There's a bill right now sponsored by Blanche Lincoln, who may not be around next year, I don't know, who wants to permanently exempt manure as a hazardous waste from the Superfund law. So all of these spills that you read about in my book, if they were to happen under her bill, that farmer and that business would be completely liability-free, would not have to spend a dime to clean it up.
And she's a Democrat.
Barely.
David Kirby is a Huffington Post contributor, author of the New York Times bestseller Evidence of Harm, which won the 2005 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Best Book. It was a finalist for the New York Public Library Helen Bernstein Award for Excellence in Journalism. He will be reading tonight where?
At Borders at Time Warner Center at 7 p.m. And I was invited to go upstairs afterwards and talk with Anderson Cooper live on the air tonight. So fortunately, it's all in one building.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.